talk, so that's kind of loud. Can we turn that audio down just a hair? How's that? Still too loud? Good morning. First of all, I want to thank you all for coming. I've called this hearing today and invited you so that we can assess the Department of Corrections planned early release of inmates at Palmer Correctional Minimum Facility, and then they have indicated earlier in the past session that they may be looking at early release of medium security inmates. With us today we have Representative Kathy Tilton of Wasilla, Representative Shelley Hughes of Palmer, Senator Bill Stoltz of Palmer, Chugiak, and Butte, and myself, Representative Jim Culver, North Palmer, Sutton, and Points East. The concern that we're going to drill into is how effective and how safe are electronic monitoring devices on inmates that are released early and what some of those public safety concerns might be. We're going to have Department of Corrections up first, followed by Department of Public Safety. We've got the Commissioner Gary Folger here, and Department of Corrections will lead off with Commissioner Ron Taylor. We'll have a brief break after public safety is done, and then we're going to have advocate for the public. She operates Stop Valley Thieves, named Vicki Wallner. And then we're going to have Michelle Overstreet of My House. They're working on some kind of a program to segue inmates back into society, and they're going to tell us a little bit about that. She's going to tell us a little bit about that program for young people. So as we're going through this, my fellow colleagues, feel free to get my attention. We can ask questions and drill in as we go because, you know, I know how important it is when we hit on a point to get the information out. So that's the point here. So, Senator Stoltz.
Yeah, thanks.
Push the talk.
Thanks, Representative Culver. I just want to, just because we happen to be a few miles from one of the facilities, the correctional facilities, this is a much more global issue about early release and ankle monitoring and basically community supervision versus Department of Corrections immediate supervision of inmates, as it's been described by a lot of folks. Some folks, when they've talked to me, said, oh, is this about the Palmer Correctional Facility? Well, in part, but it's much, 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 much larger than that. And I, just because we happen to be meeting a few miles from that facility, I just wanted to emphasize, Representative Culver, and it's, you've stated that, and the fact that we have DPS and a lot of other entities here, that it's much more global than just our concern about a local facility. We're going to have to make a lot of tough decisions and a larger issue than just the initial department issues is a pretty significant bill in the legislature right now, Senate Bill 91, which would drastically alter the way that we evaluate the importance of dealing with the criminal element. And we might have just as well had fish and game here as well, because we're going to talk about catch and release. So that looking forward to hearing the presentations. Thank you, Representative Culver.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz. One other bit of information for the public that's here. When we get to the end of our presentations, our invited testimony, we'll have opportunity for public testimony to the legislators here. 3 minutes per person, and we'll have a sign-up sheet over here on this table by the window, the media window. So with that, we'll open it up to you, Commissioner Taylor. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you, Representative Culver, and members of the legislature. First of all, I want to thank you and the public for actually hosting this. It's not often that we get an opportunity to be in front of the public and allow them a chance to weigh in on the criminal justice reforms that are occurring right before our eyes. And so it's important that whether it's Palmer or Bethel or whatever community that we go to, that they have an opportunity to weigh in and to gain a better understanding of what's actually happening in these times that we're dealing with right now. As you know, the department has been focused on successful prisoner reentry. And so what we're trying to do is look for ways that we can assist people to be more successful so that they're not a public safety risk, or we lessen that public safety risk when they are returned to the community. The Palmer ramp down, as it's being referred to, is not necessarily the ramp down of Palmer minimum, nor is it the closure of Palmer medium. It's actually looking at all of our minimums across the state to determine who can we put on, not early release, that's not what we're dealing with here, but allow them to serve their sentence on electronic monitoring or halfway house or through some other fashion. I want to make sure that that's clear, because it seems as if the department is just opening the doors and just letting people out, and that's not what we're saying. We haven't said that, and we're not saying that now. In September, we have received a letter from the legislature, the leadership, and I just want to comment on what was written in the letter. It says, prison beds are expensive and should be reserved for those who have committed the most serious crimes and who pose the greatest risk to our communities. In that letter, they asked for recommendations that enhance public safety, strengthen alternatives to prisons, and determine which criminal defendants and offenders can be safely managed with those alternatives. That's what we're talking about today. We're talking about if prison is too expensive, which is about $142 a day for a hard bed, about $50,000 per year per person that we house in one of our facilities, is there a much safer way to manage that person? Is it also a way that would not decrease public safety or increase the risk to the public, but actually allow them to serve their sentence on electronic monitoring? Today we have, I'm going to look at our count sheet real quickly. Today we've got 446 persons on electronic monitoring. We have another 649 persons in our halfway house. The remainder, just under 4,300, I believe, 4,800, are in one of the institutional beds. So it's pretty clear for us. It's pretty clear that given our budget crisis that we're in right now, that we've been given some very specific direction. We need to reduce our population. The letter also went on to say that the Department of Corrections need to avoid or avert any future growth over the next decade, which is about $169 million, or an additional 1,400 people that would come into our system, and we need to look at several options. Not only do we need to avoid all of those costs, we need to reduce our population by 15%, which for us represents about 790 reduction over what we have right now. And then we need to look at a reduction of 25%, which represents about 1,300 people.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Beard. Yes, thank you, Commissioner. You said a growth of 1,400 over what time span?
To the chair, to Representative Hughes, it would be over a decade.
Can you back up, Commissioner? You said you gave us some numbers. You said 790 and then 1,400. What do those represent again?
Okay. So the first number that I gave you was the 1,400. The 1,400 would be what the prison population is expected to grow over the next decade. The 790 is what we're being able to, or what we were asked to look at in terms of a 15% reduction in our population. That means that's on top of the growth. So that's on top of that 1,400, taking an additional 790. The 1,300 that I referred to is taking a 25% reduction.
Okay, so in this current fiscal year, what's the numbers that you're looking at, and what kind of timeline?
So in the current fiscal year, what we had originally set up was looking at basically 176 to see if we could reduce a minimum of 176 out of our population, out of all the minimums across the state, not just Palmer.
Mr. Chair.
Rep.
Just for clarification, so the 15% reduction or the very aggressive 25% reduction, you're talking of the institution beds, right? So of the 4,800 some institution beds of the current population?
Through the chair to Representative Hughes, that's correct. The number that we started with was 5,267. So it would be 15% of that, and it would be 25% of that. So we've already started doing this. We've been doing this at least a couple of years now in terms of looking at ways that those persons that really do not need to be in the institution can be safely moved out. I'm glad that we're here because it gives the public an opportunity to finally weigh in on this question. As Senator Stoltz said earlier, this is a much global question than just Palmer. It is something that we will need assistance on, and we would love to get any recommendations that you or the public may have in terms of how we take these reductions moving forward. It's pretty clear. We have to take the reductions. 95% of the persons that we have in our custody are going to be released one way or the other. It's a matter of how do they get released. Do we release them to some sort of supervision, or do we hold them until the end of their sentence, and then we just literally drop them off on the street? So what we've done is, we're in the process of doing, is looking at our minimum population right now to determine on an individual case-by-case basis who may be appropriate to be released. And I know in the paper a week or so ago it said DOC to release 1,200 people. No, that's not what we're looking to do. I don't even know what the number is going to be in terms of what we actually release. But we're going to release what we can, and we've got to be able to build up the capacity at our halfway houses and in electronic monitoring that we don't have today, because we don't know what those numbers are going to be. We certainly have to do our due diligence and work with our local law enforcement, whatever community that they're going to be released in. And the majority of these guys are going to be released in Anchorage. And so we would have to not only work with the troopers, we certainly will need to work with Anchorage Police Department for the instance of somebody who may cut an electronic monitoring bracelet or walk away from the halfway house. Those are things that we're actively working with them right now to be able to look at, and we certainly need to look at ways to strengthen both electronic monitoring and our halfway houses.
Senator Stoltz has a question, Commissioner.
Thank you, Commissioner. And when we hear about the population of prisons, there's often commentary about warehousing drug offenders. How many, can you tell me, and this is people that have only an offense for marijuana possession, no other affiliated offenses, and two, only offenses for narcotics possession and non-sellable quantities, and no other, you know, allied offenses. What's the population, just if you were to be able to, how many people are in for marijuana? As we hear on radio commentaries that we're full of people, and as well as we're warehousing drug offenders. And,
through Representative
Cole. And with the parameters I described.
Okay, to Senator Stoltz, just purely marijuana, about five or six in our population, just purely marijuana. I'd have to get the numbers for the total drug offenses that we have.
Under 100?
Oh, it would probably be a little bit more than that.
It's varied over the years,
mm-hmm.
between 50 and over 100.
That's correct.
Yeah. I just wanted to, so, folks, I just wanted to put that on the record. And drugs are clearly an alcohol or certainly a accelerants in creating crime, but by your testimony of the population, and would you of that say if it's say even if it's 125, it'd probably be a fair estimate on the high end for narcotics. It's been below 100 on sometimes I've asked. Say 150. Say if you took 150 and then you're 5 or 6, what percentage of the population is that?
If it's if it's 150, then that's whatever that percentage is of 5,000, basically, what we're talking about in terms of the institutions.
So about 3%.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to, not trying to dominate it, but I wanted to frame the debate because many people believe that that's the what's filling up our prisons. An institution is drug offenses, and you don't have to listen to much talk radio and not hear that on a regular basis. So on the high end, probably less than 3%. Commissioner?
Thank you. No, I'm going to trust your judgment on that, Senator Stoltz. Until I get the numbers, I don't really want to go ahead and say that.
Okay. Under 5%? Come on.
We'll go with 5%, Senator Stoltz, and I reserve the right to change that.
Okay, you'll get those to us fairly soon then. Right?
Yes, I will.
Thank you.
No problem. Appreciate that. Representative Hughes.
Thank you. It sounded like an auction there for a minute. Commissioner, you mentioned when you first started the list of numbers, I believe you had 446 persons right now on ankle monitors. Could you just give us a very brief understanding of how long that program's been in existence? The typical person that might be that is on ankle monitors now, where they live, are they in a halfway house, are they in their own home, do they have a supervisor? Just to give us a basic understanding. If I did hear you correctly, I think you said there were 446 on ankle monitors right now.
The persons that we have on electronic monitoring, there's minimum requirements that we have for that. Their release date has to be less than 3 years. There can be an override by the commissioner. No current offenses for sex offenses or related convictions. No current domestic violence or related convictions. They have to have a landline with basic service and long-distance carrier. And then we look at those cases on an individual basis to determine who to place on electronic monitoring. Right now we have them in, I believe it's 8 communities, primarily Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, Kenai, the Wildwood area, and I'll think of the other ones here in a second in terms of where we have them at. Thank you.
Commissioner, while we're on that, what criteria and method do you have? A policy? Is there a regulation? Will be used for vetting inmates for possible electronic monitoring that are now institutionalized? And can you explain what that protocol will look like that the department will use as a factor or a evaluation tool, and is it something we're working on? Is it something that's policy, regulation?
So we can
get a clear view of what the guidelines are existing and will be as you look at I call it early release because they're out of the institution, but go ahead.
So in determining whether to designate a prisoner to electronic monitoring, as a commissioner, I have to look at the safeguards to the public, the prospects for the prisoner's rehabilitation, the nature and circumstances of the offense, the availability of programming and facility space, the needs of the prisoner, and the record of the convictions that the person brings into our system, the use of alcohol and drugs, and other criteria that we've designated in the past, which has been for example, no sex offenders. Other than that, that criteria is pretty broad and pretty flexible to allow us to move people from inside the institution out.
So your sole discretion as commissioner in making these decisions at the current time?
I wouldn't say it's my sole discretion as commissioner. We have an electronic monitoring unit that actually looks at those applications and brings people onto electronic monitoring. That's been delegated to them.
Okay. Well, I would hope you would work with legislators like myself that are interested in this. That seems to be a very broad brush without any general specifics. And for the concern that I think a lot of us are here today, public safety, we need something more than that before we roll this out. We need, you know, types of offenders. Are these monitors going to be equipped with GPS? You know, what are we going to do when one's cut off, when we get a signal that they're no longer, you know, within the range of where they're supposed to be? These kind of things. How we're going to enforce actual compliance with electronic monitoring if this is the way the department is going to go. Some of these basic specifics that can assure the public that there's some safety. And then the other thing I think that I need to ask you with regard to this issue, are you going to notify the prosecutors and the victims that these inmates now are going out on EM? And do you do that now?
Victim notification, Representative Culver, is a part of anybody going out on electronic monitoring. They have to have input into that process. And in terms of the direction that the department has been moving in, electronic monitoring has been around a while, and so it's not moving in. We've already been doing it. We've got 466 people, or whatever number I gave you a few minutes ago, that are actively on it. 446 that are actively on it. Over the past year, we've had about 1,400 cases in Anchorage. In Palmer, we've had 262, and statewide, a total of 2,395 persons that have actually been on electronic monitoring at any point during the year. And when we're talking about the number of people who have literally cut a bracelet off, we're talking a handful, 4 to 5 people that have cut a bracelet off on our electronic monitoring. Those 4 or 5 persons, as soon as that bracelet was cut off, actually ended up coming into our office, turning themselves in. They didn't pose that public safety risk. For those that we are very concerned about, that when they cut their bracelet off and we have to actively look, we will work with law enforcement to ensure that we partner with them to go and find that person as quickly as possible.
Now, thank you, Mr. Chair. A quick question and then my real question, just because I have a little bit of a hearing deficit. Did you say 4 to 5 or 45 that have cut their monitors off?
Four to five.
Okay, thank you.
4 to 5.
Okay, and then my question is, you went down through a list of considerations to determine whether someone would qualify for electronic monitoring, the safeguards of the public, the nature of their crime, the chance of rehabilitation, et cetera. And I understand that as the current criteria. Are there people right now, as you're trying to shoot, I believe you said a reduction of 176 for the current year, are you expecting there are people that are in institution beds that fit the present criteria? Are you considering softening the criteria so that you can get the numbers up on electronic monitoring? And if you are going to change those criteria and make them less stringent, what are you planning to change?
Through Representative Culver to Representative Hughes, that's an excellent question. Right now we have about 1,200 people who are eligible for electronic monitoring based on the current criteria today. We're looking at them first. And I believe that we can get a number of those persons out. We're not looking to change any of the criteria at the moment. We're just looking to work within the current framework that we have to see who can be moved out.
Follow-up? And you said you're not looking at changing any of the criteria at the moment. Are you looking at looking to change the criteria in the future? And when might that future be, and what might the changes be?
If the public is as concerned about electronic monitoring and feels that they need to have additional safeguards, we certainly would take that into consideration. It is not something that we're looking at today. It's not something that has been on our radar. Again, we've got 1,200 people that are eligible right now. It's beginning to look at those cases to see who can be moved out, whether that's 50, whether that's 100, 200. I don't know those numbers yet, and until I get those and know who we're dealing with, I can't really give you a whole lot of information on those cases yet. The only other thing, Mr. Chair, that I was asked to do then was to talk about, I believe it was Mr. Beebe's case. Mr. Beebe, on July 15th, was arrested and placed in our custody. He was originally placed at Mat-Su pretrial on July 20th, and then we moved into Goose Creek Correctional Center, where he is still in custody. That's been the Department of Corrections' involvement with Mr. Beebe. I understand that there were some concerns that he was on electronic monitoring, but it wasn't the Department of Corrections' electronic monitoring. That was a third-party bail condition, and that was a bail company that the courts utilized for electronic monitoring. And I don't really have any information on what they would do or what criteria that they would use in terms of their electronic monitoring.
But the corrections uses a private vendor for electronic monitoring as well as the court system through third-party vendors?
No, sir.
You do it yourself?
That's correct, sir.
Okay. And their radio frequency for in the home that they're, or their area that they're, home detention or whatever, their perimeter, or are they GPS equipped?
It depends on the person and what we're using it for. If we're using it for GPS, that's one. If we're using it for to monitor alcohol, that's the other one that we would primarily use.
But we could equip them with GPS so that we can track these inmates that are released, make sure that if we can backtrack and see where they were or whether or not they have that monitor on, right?
We certainly can.
Well, just looking at some of the other situations. Colorado's had a lot of other states had budget reductions several years ago as we were undergoing it and have gone through these kinds of things. And from some of the information that I've gathered that, they had an inmate that put the monitor on his dog and then went out and offended, and the corrections department went through a third-party vendor, and they thought the inmate was still in the house where he was supposed to be detained, but he was out committing crimes. So there's ways around these things, and I just, we're trying to drill into how we can get comfortable with the protocol and the procedures that will be employed here.
No problem.
Representative Hughes and then Senator Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering if you could tell us, just so we have a good understanding as we go forward, when someone is on electronic monitoring, what other kind of requirements for someone, for instance, is drug testing being required on a regular basis, and depending on the crime, what other kind of things might be paired with someone on electronic monitor to help ensure public safety?
They're reporting to a probation officer twice a week, one for testing, weekly testing. Depending on the circumstance, we may increase that. And certainly they're checking in with their probation officer to ensure that they're employed and that they're going through whatever treatment or program requirements that may have been required for them being on electronic monitoring. And we're actively monitoring them. We are going out and doing home visits as well as ensuring that they are where they're located at. we're doing spot checks on them as well.
Senator Stoltz.
Thanks, Representative Culver. Commissioner used a 3-year standard for looking at eligibility for electronic monitoring. Is that the 3-year sentence, or is that the truth in sentencing sentence, as you're probably familiar with?
It is a, if they're 3 years from the time that they're being released, that's what when they're eligible, and that's
with
statutory.
Calculating good time and...
That is true.
So it could be somebody with a 5 or 6 year sentence, but with the calculations, they'd be eligible because
of
the good time provisions.
Although electronic monitoring, they would lose that good time, so that would be changed. So it would actually go back to being the truth in the sentencing if they're going to go on electronic monitoring.
And just as this has been talked about, and the legislature actually made a policy change this last spring, allowing greater discretion electronic monitoring, I believe. I think it, did that bill pass or not? I can't remember.
It did pass in terms of utilizing electronic monitoring for pretrial, if that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, okay. I'm just trying to remember that. You're probably pretty familiar with Article 1, Section 24, the voters approved in 1998, I believe, the Victims' Rights Constitutional Amendment. It's in Article 1, Section 24, and as well as a couple other sections of the Constitution. To what degree has the Office of Victims' Rights and Victims' Rights Advocates been involved as these policies have been formulated?
I know in times past when we've had task force, we've invited them to be certainly a part of that. Right now, as part of the criminal justice reform, victim advocates, Bethel and Fairbanks was the communities that we actually had forums for specifically victims to get their input into some of the changes that would be recommended by the Criminal Justice Commission.
There's also a legislatively authorized commission, or it's an agency within the legislature to implement the victims' rights, and those folks have some broader powers and some constitutional charges that just local advocates might not have. They may coincide, but we're not sure. Has the Office of Victims' Rights been involved in the implementation and development of this new regime?
In the past, I'm sure they have been involved, Senator Stoltz.
Well, how about now as we're dealing with this? Because there's a lot of things moving very quickly. And
I'd have to check with the Criminal Justice Commission on that to see if they've
been involved. I guess I'm a little bit... I don't want to get testy on this, but that's the Constitution and victims' rights. We swing around the Miranda stick quite a bit, but this is one that the voters approved by about an 83-84% margin. The legislature is elected to put funds in, even in difficult times. I just think they should be taken a lot more seriously. Thank you, Commissioner. And I'm not trying to be combative. I'm very defensive of that provision of the Constitution. I got to help on that provision and help on the creation of the Victims' Rights Office to help implement it at the time. We passed a lot of constitutional amendments post-Civil War, and it took about 90, 100 years to implement them, and we were on a much more aggressive, forceful timeline of making sure that the victims of crimes are treated respectfully and within those, a lot of shadows in the criminal justice system, and I don't want the victims to be stuck in those shadows of darkness of no information, because that's re-victimization.
Absolutely, sir. We agree.
Thank you. I'm not trying to proselytize, but this is a pretty key part of the whole discussion, and I think it's all too often dismissed. The Pew Charitable Trust folks that came around, they volunteered to help us rewrite our criminal justice system. Not only were they unaware of our strong victims' rights provisions in our constitutions, they didn't seem that concerned about them. So my red alert is on high focus right now.
Well, Mr. Chair, they were part of the group that went to Bethel and Fairbanks to actually look at that. To talk to the victims on the on changes that could be occurring in terms of reforms.
Given their lack of understanding and lack of concern, that doesn't comfort me a lot that they took the field trip, but we'll go on.
Okay. Thank you.
Very good point. Representative Hughes.
Thank you, and I thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Stolt, because I do think victims' rights are paramount. You mentioned engaging in Bethel and Fairbanks on that issue, having a forum. Do you have plans to do that and engage with victim groups here in South Central? And then also, part two of the question is, when someone, it's determined someone is qualified to be on electronic monitoring, is there consideration as to what community they will be placed in regard to where the victim is living? In other words, are they put in a different community? So the South Central question, and then where the inmate is placed in regard to the victim.
To Representative Culver, to Representative Hughes, a separate town hall meeting or public discussion hasn't been developed yet in terms of just specifically to get the victim input. Certainly this is one of the ones we took advantage of so that we can get some public input into the process. The second part of your question, do we consider where the victim lives? Absolutely we do. In terms of saying you need to go to a different community because the person is in Palmer, that may not necessarily be the case. They could still be here, but we would have restrictions on areas that they could be in.
Well, that's one thing. First of all, I would encourage you to engage and set something up in South Central, in Anchorage, as well as in the Matsu, the Kenai, and, cover those parts of the state. But also, I would feel more comfortable knowing someone were in a totally different community than just separating areas, and I'm guessing that the public and many people might agree with that, so that might be something you want to consider when there's a victim involved. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Commissioner, a couple more. So what's the procedure employed when offenders violate? They don't show up for a drug test. They don't pass a drug test. They're outside the boundaries of their ankle monitor. How fast is the response, and what are the consequences?
The alert is given to our probation officers who will work with law enforcement to get that person picked up. It depends on the person, how quickly we can get to them. We have people on call for 24 hours to be able to deal with those violations. In terms of the consequences, that's left up to the court or to the it depends on what they were out on. If they're serving their sentence and they were out on for court, then they would go back and they would be violated through that process. And we put them back in a hard bed at that point and deal with that process. Some may even get charged with a new crime, depending on what type of violation that was.
Okay, so what you're referring to is kind of pre-trial activity. Let's just, for hypothetical, you're looking at a release of 176 minimum security inmates. One of them out of their area, doesn't pass the drug test, whatever. What is the department response time going to be, and what are the consequences? Are they going right back into a hard bed? Are they going to get a sled in the gym or wherever, the nearest correctional facility? What is that going to look like?
Again, it depends on the community, Mr. Representative Culver, and they would go into a hard bed. And if it's in the office, we would arrest them on the spot and take them back. If it's in the community and we're there, we're going to arrest them and take them back. Our probation officers have arrest powers.
What kind of, what's your average response time for these kind of infractions at this time?
Again, if they're in the community, they're going to pick them up right then, sir.
An hour, 2 hours, 3 hours?
I would have to check with our electronic monitoring group to see what our response time is. I don't think that it's that long, to be perfectly honest with you, when we get notified and when we start going out and looking.
Okay, I appreciate that follow-up because that's critical information, how quick and how effective you
okay.
are right now.
We can do that.
And, you know, living up to these means of incarceration. Okay, now here's a – so how much is projected to be saved by you talking about the next rollout, 176 minimum security inmates? What is the cost savings in your budget?
I'm not sure that there are going to be any cost savings. There may be some cost shifting, if that's what you're asking me. I'd have to get the numbers from our budget person in terms of that shift because we're going to be moving them from a hard bed to one of three areas. They're going to go out on discretionary parole. They'll be going to a halfway house or electronic monitoring. So it'll all depend on where we end up releasing them from.
Well, it's approximately $110 a day if you're going to electronic monitoring from a hard bed, 26 from 143, right, or a little less than 100, but maybe 100 and whatever. So there are some cost savings there. Now, during the budget, as the Department of Public Health and Social Services was trying to get the legislature to implement Medicaid expansion, it was touted that $6 million would be saved in corrections. So that wasn't approved. It wasn't a part of your budget. Now it's been implemented by the governor. So where's that money going? Why can't we use that as more of a tamping down to do a pilot project, if you will, or something on this early release from institutions to these halfway houses and electronic monitoring? So you got supposed to have $6 million extra dollars now available because of your medical care costs in the department.
Mr. Chair, we don't have $6 million extra dollars or $7 million extra dollars.
Somebody
that's $7
million
that would replace the money that was taken out of the budget. And that $7 million would specifically go for medical care, period.
Senator Schultz, you want to follow up on that? Because it was never in the budget, so it wasn't in the approved budget to that you were expected to save $6 million in medical costs. So you got a bonus after the fact, after the, when the fiscal year began, when this was implemented. So that was what was pitched, and so you should have $6 million extra dollars within your department to apply to other activities.
Representative Culver, if what you're referring to is that the original $7 million that was on the table would have been taken out as a result of Medicaid if it was passed, the legislation was passed, that would have been a reduction of $7 million in our GF, in our general funds. When that was not approved, those $7 million remained in GF. So there was no bonus. It was just the money that was there to cover the medical costs.
Right, so the $7 million's in the budget to cover the medical costs. And then after the budget was passed, the governor implemented it. And Department of Health and Social Services, they had a number. They said it was 100 and some million that was going to be saved to state agencies and in the budget. It wasn't put in the budget. And your department was estimated to save $6 million. So if those inmates are signed up for Medicaid, there's going to be a cost savings to the department. Correct?
At some point, Representative Cole, but it won't be today, and it probably won't be through the end of the fiscal year, if that's what you're getting at.
Yeah, what I'm getting at is, do we need to move as quickly as we are on in this emphasis on releasing folks into the community before their sentence is up when there's some other money out there that perhaps could cover offset these costs?
Actually, this is being driven by the legislature, the governor's office, and what's going on across the country. So it's not something that I would say I'm in necessarily the driver's seat on doing.
Right. Representative Hugh.
Commissioner, the $6 million, $7 million should be saved in your budget in this fiscal year if you're not going to make liars out of the administration, because they said that was the expected savings thereabout in one fiscal year. So just keep that in mind, and that, you know, we will be looking for that. I serve on the, as you know, on the Corrections Finance Subcommittee, and I'll be very curious in that regard, because that was definitely stated. And while we're talking about cost, could you go $142 a day for an institution bed? Could you give us, I know Representative Colbert, the chair, mentioned a few dollar figures, but I want to make sure I understand the cost per day for institution bed versus electronic monitoring, and the amount that you are expecting to save annually by the plan that you're putting forward by moving people to electronic monitoring. Because at one point, I think you maybe misunderstood you, but I thought you said something about we don't know what we're going to save, we don't know if we're going to save, and that just kind of threw me off, because I thought this was very much about not just keeping the numbers down, but keeping the numbers down because we can't afford to have the numbers grow. So if you go over those costs for us, please.
The cost for hard bed is $142.66. Mm-hmm. For electronic monitoring, $22.68.
So the expected savings?
Again, until we find out the numbers of how many are going to electronic monitoring or a halfway house, it's difficult for me to say that we're going to have automatic savings in terms of that, because we still are responsible for paying for medical costs and a number of other things that would be factored in there.
Okay, so but you gave us 100, you know, the goal to reduce 176 this year, and then down the road expected over a decade. So you haven't run those numbers yet. I mean, I can do the math.
That's correct.
But, okay.
On the numbers that I gave you earlier, that was what Pew estimated, that if we continue doing nothing over the next decade, we're expected to grow by $169 million, 1,400 new persons in our custody.
Okay, thank you. And so if we multiply 176 times $22.68 times 365 days, I guess we can figure out the one-year savings.
I'd be careful with doing that when we know that we've got to increase electronic monitoring, make sure that they have programming, and whatever is going to be able to address the needs for transferring them. We got to make sure that those issues are being addressed as well. And so I'm not sure that there's going to be a whole lot of cost savings once we start bringing those things online, which is why I referred to earlier, we may have some cost shifts. So we would shift them from the institution into electronic monitoring, into halfway house, into programming.
Okay. Yeah, and my math would have been wrong. It would have been the difference between the two. Thanks.
Okay, what, first, give us, for the record, the cost per day on the halfway houses, just so we have that.
$89.27 per day.
Okay, and Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Commissioner. Just off the topic a little bit of the costs here, the court views, which I assume if we're looking at a lot of enhanced community monitoring assistance, it doesn't have real detailed, really has very little information on the sentencing on there. Would the department, I won't even try to guess what the courts are going to say, but would the department have a problem with more detailed sentencing information being on the court views?
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, I don't think we would.
Okay, well, I won't take that as an implicit endorsement, because I'm asking on the cuff, but something I'd like to pursue if we're going to ask folks to be involved in assisting state government and the administration of justice. It's probably good to have more tools on there. They certainly know how to monitor sex offenders. That's real clear. So, thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner, appreciate coming down
thank
today.
You, sir.
We do, as a follow-up, I do want to work with you on what your release evaluation process is going to be before we do this, the next round. Something that we have that's very concrete and analytical, so that the public has is fully aware of what the department's doing, and so we can ensure that, as our oversight role, that we're looking out for public safety. So is that going to be possible? Is that something we can work on before this is rolled out the next phase?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, with that, we'll tee up Department of Public Safety Commissioner, and he's got a couple of folks with him to assist. Does the panel want to take a quick break or roll right into this? Okay, we're ready to roll then. Welcome, Commissioner. You want to go ahead and state your name and affiliation?
Good morning. For the record, my name is Gary Folger. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety.
Thank you, Commissioner. Please proceed.
I'll start out. Recently, I've met with my counterparts from the western states, and as you mentioned earlier, some previous states or other states have budget issues too, and they've rolled out releases, so to speak. The Los Angeles County in the last year and a half have rolled out between 10 and 12,000 prisoners. And a couple things that came from that one was they probably didn't hire enough probation officers. You know, the first person that probably sees these folks. And the second thing, and it's a social issue, was the homelessness. The liaison told me that the population of Skid Row had tripled in population, something they did not anticipate. And so what I'm ultimately saying here is releasing, or early release, however you want to word this, is more than just any one department. It's a mental, some of it can be largely due to mental issues, monitoring these folks. In the end, the person in the public asks themselves, am I safe? And from the department's perspective, when you call us, we will come. And that's the bottom line. And, it's my job, it's our mission. We prioritize calls, and in the end, when you dial 911, we will come. Another thing I'll bring up too is there are many groups working on this issue. It's just not corrections. It's just not public safety. And it's going to involve your group too. It's going to involve the judicial branch. What are we doing? And we want to proceed in a safe manner. So in the end, am I safe? So.
Thank you. So do you think... are you comfortable with the kind of very loose definition of who's eligible to be released? If this may not be, in your scope, what is there concerns in the department as far as having to increase your workload because now we've got more offenders, potential offenders out there, and the risk to the public? What, any comments on that?
I think the devil's in the details. Is this a court-ordered release versus, corrections going through it? And is this an administration violation or a court violation of some kind of the release? And again, the devil will be in the details, and that's, I think, where the issue is. So
would you feel more comfortable if we had more of a defined set of criteria that we were using, that the Department of Corrections was using for evaluation of this process, the downsize?
Yes, sir.
Well, perhaps you would be partner with us on that evaluation so that we can craft something that is definite rather than very undefined, if you will.
Yes, sir. Just to expound a little bit about this visit with my counterpart, legislatively, the state of California is looking at raising some of the, what we would consider misdemeanor or lower end felonies, like drug possession, a certain amount of it being reduced to misdemeanors. The one scary part that he shared with me is felons with firearms. You were looking at turning into a misdemeanor, and this is going to be part of that SB 91. You know, again, the devil's in the details. So.
Senator Stoltz.
Thank you. And I also have the opportunity. There's a major piece of legislation sitting in the committee I chair, and I'll be taking that up later. It's a Senate bill. But just your reaction of evaluating these prisoners. We have the probation officers and the COs, but what would you think of the idea of the professional organizations that that represent both the COs and the or state troopers or local law enforcement? They know these folks better than just about anybody, and you know, we have those folks on evaluation of judges and other forums. I'd sure like to have, just as you've been involved in law enforcement, I won't ask you to answer for Commissioner Taylor about whether COs organizations be involved. I think they're more liberated and free to talk if they're not on the clock about what they think about certain things. Do you think they have a role in helping evaluate?
Through the chair, Senator, there is no doubt they have a role. In the end, we're all partners, and management versus them. It's a togetherness issue. Sometimes we don't always see eye to eye, but in the end, it's for the good of the all. So.
Some of us may have issues with folks when we're dealing with pay issues and stuff throughout the year, and that's a natural thing. But I know when we're dealing with various criminal bills, some of the folks that testified, they had to take off their hat of their employer very implicitly, and I think sometimes under duress because they were shifting politics. I appreciated somebody that was able to, somebody that belongs to Anchorage Police Department Association or the Public Safety Employees Association or the correction officers. It's a lot more liberated and can be a lot more candid and say, hey, here's what's going on here, and hopefully without retribution. I mean, it's, we want this thing to work. We don't want it to be sugar-coated. We don't want it to, and I don't think we should be overly driven. I'm not part of the legislative leadership. I didn't sign that letter. I probably wouldn't, or I would have had a lot of cautions on it because be careful what you ask for in the budget process. But I appreciate that. Well, I'd like to follow up more with both you and the other commissioner about the involvement of the organizations. I know it's been my I hear more between quarters at a football game at a Colony or a Palmer game than I do in a committee from correction officers or in a grocery store at the post office. They're often even reticent to talk then. So if we can find a way to protect people so they can be a valuable part of the evaluative process. Thank you for that. Thank you for straying over the level.
No problem. I think that's very valuable. In fact, we received a letter for this hearing, and it's available to whoever wants it. I think we may have it on the counter from the Correction Officers Association, that they are very concerned about that, especially it's mixing populations of inmates, and they're not in favor of it. We have a question from Representative Hugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Folger, for being here. And just to kind of to follow up with what Senator Stoltz was asking about as far as the various partners you mentioned, it's not just not DOC, and having experience and having insight into the release and whether it's a good idea, not good idea, or how best to structure it. And I'm sorry if I missed it earlier from Commissioner Taylor, but right now when there is a specific consideration as they're going through the list of criteria to determine whether someone should be released, early released on electronic monitoring, does public safety actually have a seat at the table and discuss those inmates, or is that you're not at the table at that point?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, no, we're not at the table.
And
But I will say that we could probably have a say when those criteria or guidelines are laid out, but at the individual cases, no.
And as a follow-up to that, would you see that that might be valuable and might provide another layer of protection for the communities and the public? Do you think there might be value in having you at the table?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, very much. It would be a valuable.
And I have another question. I was just wondering, 446 currently on electronic monitoring now throughout the state. Do you see that your ratio of interaction, could you just talk about your interaction with someone who's on electric monitoring? Is it rare? Is it frequent? And also whether you're hearing from victims that they're concerned because a person is out on electronic monitoring.
The only time we would ever hear from victims if it was the matter that was ongoing, and a large part of those calls would be from those folks, like the person's violating the conditions. To say that it's a large part of our business, I would say no.
A follow-up. Is it relatively common, though, that you would hear, or uncommon that you would hear from a victim of someone out on electronic monitoring?
When that call comes, it is very common, yes. And those calls do occur, mainly because they know the defendant or the person, and some kind of interaction is ongoing or occurring. We would definitely hear.
And follow up with a short one.
Go ahead.
Just the first part of that question about your interactions with the person on electronic monitoring, is that less than, let's say, before their pre-institution days, or is it the same? Are you seeing that's adding to your workload? Just talk a little bit about that.
To the chair, I'm going to fall back on human nature. You know, the best predictor of future performance is past behavior. To say that those folks that we encounter that are on electronic monitoring, more often than not, it's we take care of the business at hand, because it's probably a new and ongoing issue. But to say that it's any more than any others, I wouldn't say that.
Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate your attendance today and shedding a little light from the public safety angle. You have accompanying with you Colonel Jim Cockrell and Captain Hans Brinkle?
Yes.
Brinke?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, Colonel, you want to come and say a few words? And then the captain?
Thank you. For the record, I'm Colonel James Cockrell, Director of the Alaska State Troopers. I really don't have an opening statement. I will say that we've been working closely with corrections to ensure that when they move out the program or continue the program that they are already working with, that we're unison, and at least in our response and how we're going to potentially deal with issues. They've been pretty upfront with what they're doing, and I certainly appreciate the candor talk that Commissioner Taylor and we've had in his staff over the last couple of weeks. There's certainly a concern on our part. First of all, you know, we have pre-release prisoners on ankle monitoring, which we certainly have a lot more issues with, because I don't think they get the amount of screening that they do that if they're already incarcerated. Right now, that I can't think of any real issues that we've had with inmates that have been released that have been on anchor monitoring. We certainly have more issues at halfway houses than we do, from my perspective, than we do for the people that are in anchor monitoring. However, we have had some fairly substantial issues with pre-release prisoners waiting for trial that have been put on anchor monitoring, and actually had a homicide involved in one in the Fairbanks area this year, where a person was released supposedly low risk. He cut off his ankle monitor and went and killed his girlfriend. This happened several months ago in the Fairbanks area. Plus, we've had some other issues in Fairbanks with them cutting off their ankle monitor. So, and I contributed that. The difference is because Corrections has has ways to administratively handle incidents, and they screen their prisoners a lot more than the court systems do.
Colonel, on that note, so what you indicate telling in other situations that we've got a problem in Alaska with pretrial bail release not adequately monitored, or they should have never been put out. So if there's a protective order out in a community and it's through a third-party vendor to take care of that pretrial electronic monitoring device, is that adequate public safety for that person that is in harm's way, that the protective order was issued by the court? And of that circumstance you spoke of in Fairbanks, is it something that needs you had that offense happen in a pretrial recently, a murder committed? Is that something that we need to drill into and put some more parameters in place and work with the court system that this is where the big problem is?
Well, I will tell you that I'm a lot more concerned about people released pretrial on anchor monitoring than I am people that are incarcerated, because, again, incarceration, they have a lot better screening criteria. They've seen the inmates probably for more than a year or two, and they've got administrative holds, whereas the other side, there really isn't, unless we just go arrest them once they cut it off. And the issue we also have to deal with the department is, what priority do we give them? The court or, say, corrections have given these low-level, low-risk inmates. Because we just don't have the staff to chase all these down immediately. The one in Fairbanks, we were just minutes behind them, and then we got diverted to a bomb threat at one of the high school or elementary schools, which diverted all our attention. And during that time period, you know, he ended up killing his girlfriend. Because, you know, I guess my biggest fear, whether it's pretrial or post-trial or conviction, is if we do start having issues, do we have the staff to adequately address it in state areas? Because I can't speak for municipalities, because it seems like whenever we go through these budget reductions, and as you know, AST is not immune from the budget reductions. I lost 27 state troopers, several out of the Palmer area, and about a $9 million reduction in my budget, public safety about $14 million. Is what priority and what calls do we not go if we've got somebody that's violated their anchor monitor, whether it's administratively, you know, outside of his area, or if he's cut it off. And that's one, as an agent, that's one area that we're struggling with right now, because, again, we're not covering the volume of important calls that we should be covering right now with the staff that we have. And I can't speak for the municipalities, and fortunately everybody's telling me most of these people will go to Anchorage, which is good for us because it won't be in state area.
Sounds like you have a lot of concern. So is the public safe with the current regime that the court system is employing for pretrial ankle monitors? But you're not comfortable with that. Is that correct?
What I'm saying is I have more concern about people that are released pretrial. And I don't want to pick on the judicial service, the court system, because they're under the same mandate that we are. The corrections are is to reduce our budget, our overall budget footprint. And this is the ways we're trying to do it. I mean, you can be critical, but the bottom line is we've got to make it work. And unless there's a solution out there, we're getting driven by not only the legislature, by the administration to reduce our costs. And this is the way that we're looking at reducing our costs, whether I like it or not.
So the pretrial monitors, let's just look at that situation. Those are third-party vendors that the defendant pays for?
Correct.
And so when does the notice go out to, it's the judicial services branch within the court system that's responsible for monitoring that bail?
Well, the court system, actually usually it's the bondsman that monitors the third part, or the contractor that monitors their client. And then through the court system, and eventually if they're in violation, either we'll get called if it's in a trooper area, or one of the municipalities will get called.
That sounds like it could be a lengthy time till it's on your radar screen if you've got the personnel to respond. So it sounds like there's a window of time when an offense can occur because of the bail bondsman, the electronic monitoring company, the contact Department of Public Safety, and then go out to try to apprehend that person if they can find them, that we have a window out there where we could potentially have a violent offender or someone that was in the midst completing their business that they were under when they were apprehended.
Certainly, the system is only as good as the third-party vendor is. And certainly, there could potentially be a delay, and I know there has been delays in the past between when it actually happened and we, as an agency, were notified that the person was in violation. Okay, and I'm talking about third-party, not talking about...
Do you think we need a more streamlined process to where public safety is notified of something, the red flag's up on that
monitor? I think the perfect world would be that the state would monitor, anchor monitors, whether it's a judicial system or somebody, but actually have a state agency, part of a state agency monitor, instead of contracting it out to a third party.
Thank you. Any questions, Colonel? Any other comments, Colonel?
No, sir. I appreciate your time.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Captain Brinke? Brink or Brinke? Brinke, thank you, sir. Just go ahead and state your affiliation, your name, and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Hans Brinke. I'm the captain commander of B Detachment out here in the Mountain Valley.
Proceed.
Thank you. I did not prepare any opening statements. I'm here predominantly just to answer any questions.
Could you maybe comment on what would the impact on your force here and the MATSU if Palmer Minimum were closed, how that would affect your workload, the safety of the community, some of those, what kind of concerns would that raise with you and the folks that you supervise?
Mr. Chair, depending on how many people are going to be released from the facilities, it's my understanding that the releases aren't going to be just located in one place. Let's take Palmer, for instance. This is going to be a statewide potential release. If we're talking specifically Palmer being closed, I don't know where the individuals are going to be released to. They could be released back to Anchorage. They could be released in different communities. I'd have to know what the numbers are truly going to be to see what kind of effect it's going to have here in the Mountain Valley. If we put 1,300 people back on the road with electronic monitoring, yes, I'm definitely going to be a little bit concerned because it will potentially have that drain on the resources that we have. If it's substantially lower than that, I really couldn't tell you. Right now, I can't give you an accurate number on how many times we get a call for a violation of an ankle monitor. It's not hitting my radar as a detachment commander. It may be hit at a lower level with one of the troopers, but it's definitely not coming on my list unless there is a substantial issue that is posed from that.
Thank you. Do you receive notification if, under the current regime, they're putting out an inmate on an EM or in a halfway house within your jurisdiction, are you receiving advance notice from corrections?
Mr. Chair, we don't have any halfway houses that are here in the Massey Valley, so it would all be electronic monitoring. I'm not aware of getting the notification if they're being put onto it.
So you don't get any notification?
I can't say that I'm aware of it. I can check with other staff members.
Commissioner, are we notifying public safety of an impending release on an EM of an inmate at this time? Okay. Well, I would think that would be very important for the community in which they were going to be reentered into, that they would be aware of that. So when they get a call to that house, that they know that on their computer already is going to show we have an inmate on early on electronic monitoring under the supervision of corrections. I think we found a spot here that needs a little work, a lot of work, because how can we be assured and how can they do their job if they're out in the community, they get a call and they're not even aware that it's you again, you know, that they're going to reoffend. So if you could maybe address that real quick while the captain's here. Appreciate that. And Representative Hughes then has a question.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, I think that would be advantageous if we had the resources and ability to do that. But when you start talking like that, then you're going to open up the door for probation and parole. We release 6,000 people that are currently on probation and parole. And I'm not sure we notify the troopers when all of those guys get released into those communities. So I want to make sure that we're careful here, that we're not overburdening both of our resources. If there's concerns of a person that we're releasing, I know that we're sharing some information with them right now. But as a routine notification to them, no, we're not doing that.
Representative,
can I assume then that it's not public information who is on electric monitoring? I can't go on the internet right now and see who those 446, and is there confidentiality reasons why that's not available, or if you considered that? I'm just thinking if this is going to be a little bit more commonplace, whether that might be good. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I just want to know whether that's been considered at all.
Through the chair to Representative Hughes, none of our persons on probation or on parole or any of that is out on the public. You can certainly contact probation office if you want to know if somebody's on probation and parole. If you're concerned about whether somebody is in on supervision in one level, you can contact them. Contact us on that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So it's not confidential information. I can ask and I can get that information, correct?
Through the chair, to Representative Hughes, we'll give you some limited information. That's correct. We can at least tell you the person's on supervision. I'm not sure we're going to be able to tell you where they're. I'm just thinking about this. We'll say that they are out in the community. I'm not sure how much information we're going to be able to share on the electronic monitoring because they're actually serving the sentence.
I'd like to follow up on that. There might be some interest in communities knowing who is in, on electronic monitoring. So I'd just like to know what you are allowed and not allowed to do as follow-up.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner. We need a follow-up on your policy and what the law is on that. Now, what about the victims? The victims notified, you're paroling, or we are going to have this electronic monitoring of these inmates on the release? Victims notified.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. We'll just get the captain here to wrap up and... hope you didn't have shoulder surgery. I know that really hurts.
I did.
I hope you're feeling better.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I could follow up on one of the questions that was posed. As far as the electronic monitoring being notified, I answered no. But I will say that the corrections does make a really good habit of addressing the individuals who are high risk that have served their sentence and they notify law enforcement and the victims. I believe it's the VINE program that's also out there. It makes those notifications available. But to answer the question that was posed as far as electronic monitoring, that's still not.
Thank you. The panel have any other questions of the captain? Appreciate your time. We also have with us Adam Berg. He's the staff member of the Corrections Finance Subcommittee. I'm standing at the back of the room, so he's kind of listening to what's going on here. And then we also have Janet Ogan with Representative Keller's office back there and one of my constituents. Thanks for coming. We're going to get Vicki Wallner up now, so you members of the media, you want to stick around for this one because she is going to shine a little light on what she's heard today and see how that measures up with what's going on actually out in our community. She's been very active in trying to get law enforcement of burglaries and other crimes and I think mainly fueled by some of our drug problems that we have in our society. And Vicki will we'll take a short break, and Vicki will be up next. Representative Hughes.
I just want to say very quickly, I am going to have to leave. I appreciate this very much. I'm hoping I'll get a recap from somebody about what goes on the rest of the day, and my staff will be here shortly to help bring that recap to me. But thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hughes, for being here. So we'll take a quick short break, and then we'll be back. And Vicki Wallner with Stop Valley Thieves will be next. And then we'll proceed towards wrap-up and some public comment.